of our look at Eov at Job. And to those who were here last week, sorry. Think of it as part of the Jobian experience. But we did, in all fairness, there were two emails, so I don't feel that bad. Only somewhat. But we are in chapter 18, and we only have, after today, two more classes this year before we do the summer break. Our last date is June 16th, before the summer break. And what I would very much like to do is complete the second round of speeches in this book, meaning the, obviously those who have been here know already, but the visitors to Eov, the visitors to Job, speak in turns. First, we had Eliphaz, then Bildad, then Zophar. Each time, Job responds. And then again, the second round, we've seen Eliphaz. We're in the middle of Bildad. I want to get to the end of Zophar and Job's response to Zophar, which is chapter 21, which is a tall order. But I do believe it's possible. So we'll give it a shot. If we get to it, we get to it. If we don't, well, that happens too. So we'll do the best we can. There are sheets, I believe, on that table, unless...
Depleted.
Okay. I guess that's a good sign, right? But we are in chapter 18. If you're using the green Tanakh, you want page 1643. And a note for the people who are new... I tried to send out the source sheets in advance digitally via email, so please make sure that I have your email address that I can send them to you in advance of the classes. So to recap the start of Bildad's speech, remember that Bildad, in general, has developed an identity for us through his first speech, really, of being harsh. He is a very jarring friend to Job. He asserted in his first speech already that if Job's children died, they must have sinned in some way. That's a good way to introduce yourself as you come in as a comforter. He was a very strong defender of the idea of divine justice. He believed that sometimes people suffer in order to have a happy ending. He compared it to the transplanting of a tree, where the tree is uprooted and it thinks it's all over, and then it's put somewhere new and it actually grows and flourishes far better than it did in its original place. That was fundamentally Bildad's view the first time round. We began Bildad's speech last time, and we saw him offer rebuke, but it was not clear who exactly he was rebuking. There were two ways that we read it. One way to look at it was when he said, he addressed somebody and said, you try to put an end to words, how long will you do this? This was actually a speech to Job. And he was saying to Job, you have to listen to what we're saying instead of planning your rejoinder as we speak. That was one take. The other take was that he was actually rebuking his friends and saying, you know, instead of talking past him, we should hear what he's saying, and that way we'll be better able to respond to him, because of course we're right and he's wrong, but he needs to hear us in a way that he will accept. And then he turns to Job in the last sentence that we read, really a key sentence, in sentence 4, and he said to Job, in your outrage you tear yourself up. But because you've decided there is no justice, does that mean that the land should be abandoned? Meaning, well, there were different ways to take it, but one way to take it was, should we assume that God has left the land and abandoned everything to chance just because you say so? There could be other explanations for what you're experiencing. That's not going to shake our belief, our belief in the fundamental justice of this world. And that was what we stopped with last time, with Bildad's prelude in his second speech. And that brings us to chapter 18, sentence 5. It is, again, page 1643, if you're using the green Tanakh. And really, the rest of his speech is a block. Unlike most of the speeches in this book, which you can break down into 5, 7, 10 sentences per unit, the rest of his speech is one big block of saying, Job, wicked people suffer. Now, is that necessarily going to comfort Job? No. But that's not necessarily what it's for. Remember that we said already when we started this round of speeches in which they all emphasize the suffering of the wicked, that there are multiple reasons why they're going to emphasize that to him. One reason why they would speak this way is to say to him, Job, if you're suffering, maybe you're wicked, because wicked people suffer. That's one way he could be taking it. Another is an insistence that there is order to things, and I can show you wicked people suffering, and therefore you have to accept that whatever you're experiencing is part of some kind of order. We spent more time on it when we started the round. I'm just recapping a little bit. But here we begin sentences 5 and 6, in which he's going to say, you know, wicked people live in darkness. They live without light. Now, we'll have to examine what that means, but first let's see the sentences. He says, Gam or Rishaim Yid'ach. He says, the light of the wicked Yid'ach. Yid'ach is a funny word. We saw it in chapter 17 and noted there that it's an odd word. It means to be cut off or to jump from its place. And when a flame jumps from its place, it means it's being extinguished. So the light of the wicked is extinguished. V'lo yigash shiviv isho. The spark of his flame will not yigah. The word noga in Hebrew is light. The word in Hebrew for the planet Venus is noga, because it's a bright planet. The statement here is the spark of his flame will not illuminate. The wicked person's light will not radiate. And then in sentence 6, or hashach be'alo, light becomes darkness in his tent, v'neiro alav yid'ach, and once again his flame will, there's that word again, yid'ach, his lamp will go out. And this is poetic style for the book. Those who are familiar with Hebrew will notice the multiple words that he uses for both light and darkness, right? For light he used or, yigah, noga, Shaviv, which is a spark, Aish, fire, or again, and then Ner, which is a lamp. In the space of two brief sentences, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words that all are about light. In a space of, really, it's 14 words total. That's an awful lot that he's concentrating there, which just emphasizes the poetic aspect of it. And then in terms of it going out and being dark, he had Yid'ach twice, Choshech, but he's saying that the light will be cut off. So here's my question to you. What does he mean when he says that the wicked person's light is cut off?
They can't see between good and evil. His judgment is
interesting. So Ralph goes straight for the metaphor and says that light is a reference to clarity, right? He lacks clarity, the wicked. They're not able to make proper judgments. I like it. The only question I have is whether that's an element of punishment, because in the context, he's very clearly going to talk about their suffering. And having clouded judgment is definitely not something you want. The question is, would I view that as the punishment? Maybe. Maybe. What else can we deal with loss of light? Yes. Ner is like neshama. The lamp is like, or light is the, we compare the candle, the way we usually render ner, to the soul. Okay, so what is it saying? It's saying he's going to die, right? It's saying he's going to be cut off. It's not that his lamp goes out, it's that he goes out. And that will be another take. We're going to come back to that in a moment. There are a lot of ways you could take this. Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, in his commentary, sees light as a reference to success. And certainly when you're succeeding, you're radiant, so to speak. And so what it's saying is he's going to fail. What he's trying is going to fail. But take a look on your sheet, please. At source number 1, which has unique meaning in context in Job. But let's see what it says first, and then we'll discuss. Passage from the Talmud on this verse. Amar Rabbi Alexandri, Rabbi Alexander said, Kol Adam Shemesa Ishto Biyamav, if a man's wife passes away in his lifetime, Olam Choshech Ba'ado, the world is dark for him. And he quotes our sentence from Job, Shenamar, or Choshech Be'ahalo, the light is darkened in his tent, V'neiro Alav Yid'ach, and his lamp is cut off. Careful, Ralphie, right there. Oh, are you going to be in trouble? Be careful. We're saying something nice here. It's saying that when he lives in his tent, the tent is a reference to his wife, and therefore the light going dark is the loss when his wife is no longer there. And I say that it's a loaded sentence in the context of Job. Why do I say that? Those who remember the early chapters of the book. Sorry?
His wife wasn't there to comfort him.
Yeah, there's no light coming from his wife. His wife, as we read it at the time, was actually one of his tests. In the sense that when he's suffering and he's miserable and he's still sticking to his story, that God is wonderful and God has given me everything I have and so on, his wife says, you should just blaspheme and die. And that's her one line in the book. We don't know anything about her. She appears for the sake of delivering that line. But maybe the Talmud is saying even then she is still his source of life.
Yeah.
Like even in such a circumstance, it's still true. Perhaps Rita.
But if his wife passes away, it's still a loss for him.
Yeah.
Even if she's not the greatest,
Right, I mean, he could use a little more support. I mean, on the other hand, in fairness, as we've talked about, the book is about Job, but his wife suffered the same losses.
Yeah, that's right.
Loss of their children, loss of their wealth. I mean, she doesn't get hit with boils as he does because it's his story. You pay the price. You want your name on the marquee, you know. But it's worth noting that there's a backstory to her comment. Yes?
You know, it has to be done.
Okay. But that's the opening line in this passage, and it continues, Rabbi Yossi bar Chanina Amar Psiosav Miskatros. The Talmud continues with the next line here in this chapter. The next line in the chapter is going to speak of his steps as being sort of locked in and narrowed, and him losing his counsel. So the Talmud continues to link that also to the loss of his wife. When he loses his wife, his steps are bounded. He no longer goes out. And Rabbi Avo says, Atzasa no fellas, his counsel will collapse as well. His thinking will suffer as a result. So aside from this being testimony to the many ways in which the man relies on his wife, the statement that the Talmud is making is that perhaps when it talks about the loss of light, it is indeed metaphorical, but the subject of the metaphor is this is loss of one's wife. That would be a way to read this. Rita?
I'm just wondering, loss of light, could it be a loss of connection to God because God is light?
That's interesting. So a loss of connection to God?
Yeah. So like when he's in this state, he's not really connected to God anymore.
Right.
God's just a healing light.
It's an interesting idea, especially because it would make this more of a response to Job.
Yeah.
Because Job has talked constantly about how God won't speak to him, won't connect to him. So the loss of light, as loss of that connection, is an interesting idea. Sharon.
It's the loss of light, but if he can't see what's going on, he doesn't know everything going on in the world around him, in society. The loss of his wife has something to do with that too, because she probably told him a lot of what's going on.
We can conjecture, but certainly the idea of light representing an awareness of things, along the lines of what Ralph was talking about also, in terms of clarity of thought, I think you have that. I want to show you one other idea. Take a look at source number 2. I really like this quote from Carol Newsom. Well, she says, who's she? You can't say that by week 30. Carol Newsom, that's true, you weren't here during the winter, but Carol Newsom is a professor at Emory University's Candler School of Theology in Atlanta, but she wrote this book that I reference here, The Book of Job, A Contest of Moral Imaginations, and she examines the book from a literary perspective. She's not interested in who wrote it, is it God, that's not her thing. But she sees messages that are absolutely brilliant in terms of what the book is trying to convey. And she says here, read literally, chapter 18, sentences 5 and 6, makes a series of banal statements about the lamp in the tent of the wicked going out. But no one versed in the conventions of Israelite poetry could take the statement literally. For light has traditional metaphorical, I retyped it from there and I think I just missed that, metaphorical resonances of life, vitality, presence, and so forth. Thus, the metaphorical claim obviously has to do with the fading vitality and death of the wicked, as indeed was suggested before, that light here is life. And the statement of his lamp going out, his light being cut off, is indeed a statement about death. What I really liked about the quote is not so much the interpretation, although I think it's a valid interpretation. What I like is the way that she says, no one versed in the conventions of Israelite poetry could take the statement literally. Because for those who were here last year when we spent the year learning Midrash and hammered on, you know, time and time again, how you need to have an ear for the text in order to catch themes, that's what she's talking about. You can't just approach a particular verse in a vacuum and say, well, I think it means. Yeah, you have to look at the whole, get an ear for the language, and that will open up the possibility of being able to catch themes when they are presented, and that's what we're trying to do here. Okay, so we have been told that light is going to be cut off for him, whether the light is clarity, awareness, relationship with God, his spouse, his life, his success, all the different possible statements. But then he says something that is far more clear. He says, the wicked are immobilized by snares. Their steps are bounded. And that's what we started to see with sentence 7. And what he does here actually is, well, you'll see it. I don't need to tell you what he's going to say. We're in sentence 7. The steps of his strength will be bounded in. Mitzarim are boundaries. And his counsel will cast him down. So two ways in which he will suffer. His steps will be bounded. He's limited in his movement. And Tashlicheyu Atzaso, his counsel will cast him down. He will have bad ideas, essentially, and he is going to suffer as a result. This is interesting because what he's going to do here is going to be reflected in chapter 19 in Job's response. But we have to get there. We're not there yet. He plays here in the language, for those who caught it, with Yetzrut Sa'adei and Atzaso. He plays with that Sadi sound. He also uses the word "oh no," his strength, which elsewhere he uses to refer to one's children. But what Bildad is going to say here is that the wicked suffer in that they become trapped. But there's something else going on that's more subtle that you need to pick up on. Dan Mikra, their commentary, notes this. Look more closely at sentence 7, please, and tell me what he has said that is new here regarding what happens to the wicked. It's not just that he becomes ensnared. How does he become ensnared?
It says here, his schemes overthrow him. So he's thinking in the wrong direction, or he's not making good judgments.
He's not making good judgments, but his schemes overthrow him. In other words, until now, we've seen discussion about people suffering from outsider. He's going to put his faith in somebody who is going to betray him. Or enemies are going to come and vanquish him. Or God is going to strike him. Or anonymous suffering. His lamp goes out. We don't know how. Here, we're told, he does it to himself. The person who is wicked brings himself down. His counsel is going to cast him down. That's an interesting idea, and I believe it's new with Bildad. Continuing, sentence 8. Kishulach bereshes biraglav. He is thrown into a snare, into a trap, into a net. You can translate resha usually as a net. Biraglav, in his feet. So even if he doesn't do it actively, he is going to be sent into that anyway. Va'al sivacha yishalach, he will walk upon a sivacha, which again is a form of netting. Sentence 9, yochez be'akev pach, yachazek alav tzamim. It's a funny poetic wording here. He has put the active item here, the subject, at the end of each clause. So yochez be'akev pach is really pach yochaz be'akev. The pach being the trap. The trap will grab his heel. The snare is going to strengthen itself around him. Pasuk Yud, sentence 10. Tamun ba'aretz chavlo. the rope that is going to catch him is hidden in the earth. Umalkudata wale nasiv, his trap on the path. This is all hidden. He is safe nowhere. Everywhere he goes, he has to fear being ensnared. And again, catching the poetry of Bildad for the Hebrew speakers. Look how many words he uses to refer to a trap. Going back to sentence 8, he used reshet, 1, svacha, 2, pach was the third, samim was the fourth, chavel was the fifth, al-makodet was the sixth. Six different words, all synonymous, really, referring to the way that the wicked is ensnared, just showing that there is this poetic element to what's being done here. And obviously, the better your Hebrew, the more that becomes evident.
Vivid imagery.
Yeah. And then sentence 11 finishes this subunit about the wicked being ensnared. Sometimes people are immobilized, not because they fell into a hole, but what else can immobilize a person? Not just a trap and a hole.
Being overwhelmed
and terror and fear, precisely. Now, take a look at sentence 11, because that was ideal. Thank you. The Saviv biasuhu balahos, vehefitsuhu leraglav. Balahos or balahot is an odd word. I'm going to come back to it in a second. But he is surrounded by things that frighten him. Biasuhu, ba'ata. Is a tremendous panic, really, and that's why he's not able to move. Sometimes it's not about traps. Sometimes it's not what other people did at all. Sometimes he just is afraid, and that's what he's describing happening to the wicked person. The wicked person lives in fear that someone perhaps will take revenge on him for whatever he's done, or perhaps he is afraid someone's going to come after the wealth that he has accumulated, or it's just because he knows his own mind that he projects that on other people. He knows what he would do to other people and how he would come after them, and he thinks to himself, that's what they're all out to do to me. And so he is indeed ensnared by his own fear. Now, I said we would come back to this word, balahot, and it's going to come up twice in this chapter, so we have to. What in the world is balahot? So, let's look at our translations and see what they can do for us. In the Art Scroll, it renders balahot as demons. Oh boy. Rashi renders it as demons also. Any other translations that anyone has render it differently? Susan's not here with the Sansino.
Because of Nivhal, but it's...
Well, if it's Nivhal, then I wouldn't render it as demons. I would say it's just confusion, a state of confusion, right? Nivhal suggests someone who is... Sometimes it means hasty, but generally it just refers to confusion. And indeed, you can argue for the switching of letters, and some do. Some make the argument that it actually is confusion. If you take a look, I referenced on your sheet, I believe, no, ha, just kidding, I did not reference on the sheet. Oh, no, one second. No, I didn't. Okay, so I will tell you. Yechezkel, Ezekiel chapter 26, sentence 21. It is, if you're using the green Tanakh, you want page 1200. Sorry? Excellent. 1268, thank you. This is God talking about the punishment he is going to bring on the city of Tsur, the Lebanese city, the city of Tyre. And he says, his last sentence in the chapter, again, page 1268, 1269, Balahot etneich ve'eneich. Now here, this is really interesting. You see what they did in the English? I will make you into a fright. So here, they didn't render it as demons. Others render it as demons in both places. I'm going to sick demons upon you, is the way that it's often mentioned. The Art Scroll is inconsistent, which will come as a shock. But some render it as demons in both places. The other way to render it, though, is indeed that it's simply a source of fear. fear. And if the that's the approach that Mitzudat David takes to this sentence, that it's indeed a source of fear that we're talking about. Balahot, connecting it to Behala. So what he has said here, what Bildad has said in this speech so far, after he gave his initial rebuke, was, number one, Job, just because you think God has abandoned the world, doesn't mean that we all have to come around to your point of view. There may be other ways to explain that which you are experiencing. Number two, he says, the wicked people lose their light, whatever that means, different ways that we explain that. And then, he said, they fall into snares. Whether those are real traps, or whether these are traps of their own devising, whether they launch themselves into the trap, or whether it's because they simply are mobilized by their fear. But he's not done. Bildad then moves into something which I think could be taken personally by Job. His next few verses, sentences 12 to 15, we're now back again on page 1643. The next few verses, he says, the wicked also lose their home and their family, which was what happened to Job. Take a look. He says, Yehi ra'ev, oh no. And here, oh no, is a reference not to his strength, but to his children. Right? Which we find in the Torah. Like, Reuven is called Kochi v'reishit Oni, the first of Yaakov's strength. So that's not unusual that one's children will be called Ono, but he says that's Ono in the Hebrew, not Ono in the English. Children are also called Ono in English, but that's a separate thing sometimes. The Yehi ra'ev Ono. His children will go hungry. V'eid nachon litzala'o. And aid means a time. But here, it's a time of downfall in particular. Nachon litzal'o is ready for his tzela. What is a tzela? No, that's a tzela. Samach rib. Tzela. Tzadi laminayin. Rib or a side. Correct. It is a rib or a side. You could legitimately render it either way. For example, the Mishkan, the traveling temple the Jews had that they built in the wilderness, the Torah describes each side of it as tzela ha-mishkan. So it can be a side. It does also have the potential to be a rib. But who is the first?
Eve.
Thank you. Chava, right. Ra'iven es ha-tzelah, asher lakach min ha-adam le-isha. Right? That God turns the tzela into chava. Whether tzela is a rib or whether tzela is the side, the Gemara thinks it's a side, not a rib. All the Christian translators thought it was a rib, and frankly some of the Jewish ones too. But the point is, it's talking about his wife. It's saying that famine is coming for his children, the time of downfall is coming for his wife, which again would now make that explanation fit very well, the Talmud fit very well with what we saw, right? In other words, when the Talmud said that his loss of light is the loss of his wife, right, you had to wonder a little bit, is that a reach? And the answer is, they're not just going based on the one sentence. They're looking at it in context. And here we're talking about him losing his wife. That adds potentially to the argument that his light, was the loss of his wife as well. Okay.
This has a completely different translation altogether.
Excellent. What do we have?
Calamity shall be ready for his fall.
Calamity shall be ready for his fall. Oh, you know why? Because when Yaakov fights with that mysterious being in the night, right? Afterwards, it's v'hut solea al yirecho, which we translate as he was limping, right? He was lame. So that I think would be where they're getting that from. The downfall, they're reading tzalo like solea, which is related, obviously, to the rib side explanations. It's all of a piece, but that's where they get that from. Okay. Yochal badei oro. Pasuk Yud Gimel, sentence 13. His skin is going to be consumed. Yochal badav bechor mavet. Bechor mavet is going to consume his skin. What is bechor mavet? What's a bechor?
Firstborn.
What's mavet?
Death.
So now we have firstborn of death. That didn't help me. So what are we talking about here? So
they're reliving over Makkah's
Qur'an. Well, except that they're consuming him.
Yeah.
That it's the other way around now. So Rashi says that Bechor, sometimes in the Torah, is a reference to an officer. And we do use that sometimes. Usually I think it's Bechav Yud Resh, not Bechav Vav Resh, Bahir. But it's a reference to an officer, and he says that it's the Malach HaMavet, the angel of death, is what's being referred to as Bechor Mavet. When, you know, if we had demons a couple of sentences ago, then why not? Let's just, you know, go all out. But his skin is going to be consumed. And that, again, is a reference to something that Job has suffered. Right? He suffered boils destroying his skin. So this is now very personal to Job. He's describing what Job is going through and saying, yeah, that's what happens to wicked people. I'm now Dr. Bildad and I'm diagnosing. Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. Yinaseik me ahalo mivtacho v'sat ideihu lemelech balahos. And if before you didn't think it was a reference to his wife, now I think it has to be a reference to his wife. The line here, Yinaseik me ahalo mivtacho. That which he trusted in will be separated from his tent, Vitatz Idehu Lemelech Balahot, and will lead him to the king of Balahot, which again could mean demons and could mean fear. You could take it either way.
Could be Satan.
Well, possibly. I mean, he's already featured in the story.
King of the underworld.
Yeah. Take a look at Rashi, please, in source number 4. See what he does with this sentence, because there are multiple ways to take it. I'm going to come back to number 3, but looking at number 4. Yinatek me ahalo me ishto. He is separated from his wife. There's more to say about whether it's mivtacho, that is his wife, or ahalo, but he is separated from his wife. Vitatz ideihu, vihitatz ideihu v'tashlicheihu lakever, lemelech hashedim. She walks him and sends him to the grave, to the king of the demons. And that would fit with the counsel that she gave before when she said, blaspheme and die. She is walking him to the grave. So that would be the idea there. And it fits as well with what happens with what happens in the next sentence. Look at sentence 15, which concludes this subsection here. Tishkon be'ahalo mibli lo. Somebody who is not his is going to dwell in his tent instead. His wife is going to bring somebody else into his tent. Yezore al naveyu gofrit, and sulfur will be scattered upon his dwelling, meaning destruction is coming. He has no future. He has no survival. This is it for him. He has been utterly betrayed and driven out. There are other ways to take these sentences. As I said before, you know, there are always multiple ways to take things in Job, but I'm trying to keep things relatively simple so as not to overwhelm us. But what's happening here is that Job is being told that his wife is going to betray him, he's going to lose his children, and even his own skin will be consumed. This is what Bildad says happens to the wicked, but it's what happened to Job. And so what he's saying is, Job, do you recognize this picture? You claim that you're innocent, and you claim that you're being wronged, and all that, you know? Not so simple, says Bildad. As I said in the beginning, Bildad is the harshest of the three visitors. And it's very difficult to stomach the idea of someone speaking this way to a suffering human being. Bildad will respond, I'm fed up with this guy, because he hasn't listened, and we've been giving him speech after speech, and how dare he not listen to us? And he started it by debating. But really, this is cold. Rita.
This doesn't necessarily happen to the wicked. This very often happens to good people.
Yep. So that takes me back to the discussion that we had when we started the second round, right? You remember the session then. The recordings are available online. But that was the discussion that we had. In general, do the visitors believe this? Do they think that this is true? And we had multiple approaches. One approach was to say, they believe that it's true, but that we don't see the whole picture. That maybe, as Sofar said, maybe people are punished for not living up to their potential, and you never know what their potential could have been. Or you don't know what people did in secret. Or as Bildad had said in his first speech, maybe they're suffering in order to get some greater gain at the end. And that was one approach. And then we had this second approach, which I'm changing the order in which I presented it then. But the second approach, which I felt was likely correct, which is that it's a statement of faith. It's not so much a statement of, here are all these circumstances in which wicked people have suffered, as much as it's a statement, this is what we believe to be true. And then the third idea, somewhat related, was Newsom's idea. And Newsom's thought was that it's a worldview that's being presented, not something that can be disproved by a particular experience. We shape our view of the world based on certain philosophical ideas, cultural ideas, in many different ways. Her example was the belief that if you start a business and you work hard, it will pay off. Everybody knows of plenty of cases where that's not true, but it's still the narrative we tell ourselves within society, right? Work hard and you will get ahead. We know it's not true, but we say it anyway because this is our overall view, and any other cases that don't fit, we'll say, well, there must have been something unique that happened in that circumstance, but this is the rule for what happens in civilization. And that's what they're doing. That was Newsom's idea, and I think that there's a lot to be said for that. There's more to be said on all of this, as always. The Ralbag swings this a little bit. If you go back to source number three, Rabbi Levi Ben Gershom says in his summary of the chapter and talking about the way that his tent collapses, Tishkon ha-behala be'ahalo mibnei shalo haya shalo. Aval b'na'oba oshek v'gezel. The idea of his tent experiencing all of this, his home experiencing all of this, is because he built it with corruption. He stole from people. That's the allegation, and that is measure for measure. The wicked are going to suffer because what they did was wrong. That's Bildad's idea.
Complex.
Yeah, well, whatever, I'm not going there. So what we've seen, again, summarizing what we've seen within Bildad's approach, he began first with his rebuke. He moved on to say, Job, no matter what you say, that's not going to shape the way that we look at the world. He said the wicked suffer the loss of their light, whether that was their life or their connection to God or their clarity or their wife, however you read that. They are ensnared by traps. They're ensnared by their own traps that they set for themselves. They're ensnared by their fear, but they're unable to move, and then they lose their home, they lose their children, they lose their skin, they lose their spouse. And that brings us to the closure, the closing section, not really the closure, but the closing section. There is no closure in this book. But take a look at sentences 16 to 20. Mitachas sharashav yivashu Umimal yimal kitziro. He says, from below, the roots of the wicked dry out. He has now gone back to what he did in his first speech, where he liked the tree metaphors. So he's going to trees. He says, the roots of the wicked dry out, and from above, his harvest, the new growth, yimal, is going to be cut off. Yimal like Brit Milah. It's going to be cut. Zichro avad mini aretz. His memory will be lost from the land. Velo shein lo al pnei chutz. He will have no reputation. He will have no name outside. What do you see here? What do you see in what Bildad is saying? What's the theme? In the loss of his... in the roots drying out, the growth being cut off, his memory gone from the land, he has no reputation.
He's just describing what has happened to Job.
Could be. Could be he's describing what happened to Job.
There'll be no zecher, but he's never ever existed.
Karet, he's cut off, no zecher, he has no future. His future is gone. He already lost his kids, right? He has lost his wife. And no one's going to remember he was ever there. His roots are gone. His branches are gone. It's as though he never lived. Which is going to be very big, we'll see, in Job's response in chapter 19. He's very concerned about being forgotten. So, keep on reading. He says, Yehdefuhu Me'or El Choshech, Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. He is pushed along, perhaps by God, from light to darkness. There's that light and dark image again. Umi Tevel Yiniduhu. He is excommunicated. You wanted a correct reference. He's excommunicated from the earth. Yiniduhu is a term that first shows up in the Torah for whom? Navanati Abaretz, exactly. Cain. The punishment of Cain when he kills his brother? Navanati Abaretz, you are going to have to wander the earth. He's going to be like Cain.
It's a little ironic, you know, kind of like as the reader, and it's sort of like a meta thing, because he's talking about being forgotten, and yet he'll never be forgotten. No matter what happens on this physical earth, he'll never be forgotten, because there's a book.
Yes.
All about
the yeah. Although I have to say, with the number of people who actually read it, I'm not so sure. Maybe if he had spoken a little more simply. Take a look at sentence 19. The theme continues. Lo nin lo, velo neched be'amo. He has no grandchild. Vein Sarid bin Gurav, nobody from him remains. And that's again a reference like that of Cain, in the sense that Cain has no descendants. They're all wiped out in the flood. The idea is that he leaves nothing behind. All the people who he should have influenced in his lifetime, whether biological children, whether friends, spouse, whatever it is, there's no mark left for him. Al Yomo Nashamu Acharonim, people will be stunned at what happened to him. Which in a sense is a contradiction now, because at least that means they know. But people will be stunned by what happened. The later people, the Kadmonim Achazu Sa'ar, the early ones to hear about this, will be gripped by Sa'ar. Sa'ar, even though it's what a sin, is like Se'ara, a storm. They will be disturbed. They are going to be distraught, as in fact we are when we read this story. It's this terrible thing that's going to happen to him. And here we come to the Marismus. I feel bad for the people who were here in the last class and they said, "What's a Marismus?" And I said, "You have to wait. The people have to go away to the cottages." So, then you don't know what a Marismus is. That's the price you pay. But this is Newsom's point. If you take a look at source number 5. The dominant figure in this section that we just read, the section that started with sentence 15, the dominant figure is Marismus, which expresses totality by naming paired opposites. And I'll explain that outside of Newsom for a second, just to explain what it is that she's trying to show us, because it's brilliant what she's trying to show. The definition of a Marism is that it's the combination of two contrasting words intended to refer to an entirety. So, for example, if you wanted to say, here's a Wikipedia example, if you wanted to say that somebody searched everywhere, you would say they searched high and low, right? You present the two. Ah, this is like a game show. They searched high and low. Or if you wanted to say that I thought about it constantly, I thought about it night and day, right? We refer to the opposites. So when we use those phrases, we're using a Marismus, right? Isn't that cool? They stun your friends. So what she says is, that's exactly what's going on here, with these paired opposites. And I read these sentences, and before I looked at Newsom, I had no clue that I had read this. But she's, of course, right. Root and branch, right? If you go back to sentence 16, is the start of this, right? So Eov is told by Bildad the root is going to dry out, and also the katsir, the harvest, that growth, is going to be cut off. The idea is everything is going to be cut off. In sentence 17, his remembrance is lost from Aretz, from the land, and then Pnei Chutz, the outskirts, the outer areas, as she renders it, the pasture. So it's sort of the civilized area, and then beyond. She actually renders it as field and pasture, which is interesting. I'm not sure I'd go with that. But then in sentence 18, he is pushed from light to darkness. And then in sentence 19, he has he has no nin, he has no neched. This is his kin. And he also doesn't have a sarid bin the gurav, no remnant, which she takes to mean to refer to the Megurav, the place where he had lived temporarily, versus the family, which is the more permanent. All of that is lost. She also mentions west and east, but I don't remember seeing west and east. Did you see west and east? Oh, in 20. It's not in 20. There it is. Achronim and Kadmonim. Okay, good. So yeah, the 19, it must be a mistake in the book. It should be 20. Thus, she writes, through the symbolic action of language is the wicked, quote, driven out of the world. It's just, it's fascinating to see the poetry within what Bildad is saying. He's saying such horrible things, but he's saying it with such thought. You know, again, the question is always, is this really his speech, or is this something being written afterwards? That's always a question. But still, it's a fascinating thing. Yes?
It sounds as if he is reproaching Eeyore for having missed an opportunity to make an impact. But that's the way it sounds. You could have happened anymore, it's over, but this came over him. The best Eeyore could do, if at all,
right,
is get over it, but having missed an opportunity.
Right. So I think it depends on how you read it. I hear what you're saying. And there is this element, which we've seen now in Eliphaz as well, and we commented on it then, of sort of loss of hope. Whereas in the first round of speeches, it was universal, I think, among all three of the visitors, that they said to him, you know, if you repent, if you turn back to God, things can be wonderful. Whereas now, there's no discussion of that whatsoever. He's not saying anything about that. So I could assume maybe it's implicit. Maybe he is not cutting off hope. He's just being really harsh. But with the understanding that you can still change things. On the other hand, it's possible that Bildad is just really frustrated at this point, because he doesn't understand why Job doesn't just accept what he's saying is true. As odd as that is.
That is then his problem.
Yes. Well, his problem, but he's going to share it. You know, these are very sharing people. Everything they think is just out there.
There is this midrash that Eeyore, as an advisor of Pharaoh, etc., etc.
Yeah, and we talked about where the midrash comes from when we began. That's actually anchored very interestingly in text. It's not just an idea. Like there's a reason for that midrash on multiple levels. But the question of whether he has any guilt, as much as the midrash links him to Paro to resolve problems about the land of Utz and the word Eitzah as it's used in various places. Nonetheless, we were very clear in the beginning of the book. God said, he worships me totally. He is pure. He is God-fearing. You know, we're not meant to approach this book with a thought of he's done something bad. Even though you do find within the Talmud a stream among some of the sages who say, yeah, there was something on his record and that was what led to this. It's very difficult to read this book that way. So in sentence 21, he gives you his summary line. He says, Ach ele mishkenos avol. These are the tents, these are the dwellings of wickedness. Vizem mekom lo yadakel. And this is the place of one who did not know God. That's the sort of the epitaph that he gives for the collapsed tent of Job. If you take a look at source number 6, Ralbag notes that it's not the same thing. Calling somebody corrupt and wicked, as he does in the first half of the sentence, is not the same as saying somebody who doesn't know God. So Ralbag says the following in source number 6. Esher shechata Eeyov. Bildad is saying, maybe Job sinned. V'im lo asa aval, and if he didn't do anything wrong. Nonetheless, his wrong is in that he didn't attempt to know God to the extent of his capacity. That's also a sin, as far as Bildad is concerned. And so he said, this is the place of one who does not know God. He's indicting Job for lack of knowledge of God. So, to summarize, wicked people suffer. They may even do it to themselves. He picks out Job's suffering in particular and uses that for his illustrations of the ways of suffering. And that's, I think, a pointed message to Job. And he says they live in fear, they have no home, they have no future. All is gone for them. And I gave you at the bottom of the sheet, the table, just to show you where we've been. We had Bildad's first speech from chapter 8, where he said Job has sinned, his children have sinned, there is divine justice and punishment. He talked about the reed that collapses. And then he said one might suffer, but if things can improve, the image of the transplanted tree improving where it's replanted. And Job's reply back then was, God will not admit injustice. I can't get a date in court with God. That was where he first really presented the idea of suing God and saying, I want to haul God into court. He says, the world is run unjustly. And he gave this whole speech. He said, you want to know? You tell me I should turn to God in prayer. I should speak to God. I'll tell you what I would say to God. It's not what you want to hear. And he gave this whole tirade of challenges to God, really as a response to Bildad's claim that there is justice. Yes?
Sorry.
No.
Can I just ask you a question? Could it be that Bildad is not so much trying to make Eeyore suffer, but maybe their concept that if somebody has sinned or is a heretic, mm-hmm. you're completely denied, is there not an obligation for the person who knows that to sort of read the person the right act? So maybe Bildad feels like this, he's doing a mitzvah.
Right.
By sort of raking over the coals, as opposed to, I'm just going to try to make it look miserable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a biblical mitzvah of tochacha, that you are supposed to instruct people in right behavior. However, you have to pick your opportunities. I mean, you know, he's just suffered this horrible loss, even if you believe he's done something wrong. There's got to be a better way.
Which is what we're thinking. You need a crowd of people, and
yes.
He says it's the last thing. And you let it go and say, oh, I'll pick another time.
Right.
On the other hand, like just play the other side. And does that not make those guilty who don't stand up to him?
Right.
Maybe he feels he is sort of, it's his obligation to.
Right. And that was Sofar's point, right? In the beginning of Sofar's first speech in chapter 11, he began by saying, I can't hold myself back because all these people are sitting here silently and they're going to think that you're right. So I have to speak up. I don't have a choice. But even then, there are ways to disagree with someone. And really, if someone were to come to me and say, listen, I have this friend and this friend is suffering horribly and I think it's because his deeds are wrong and he thinks that it's because God is wrong, and I want advice on what I should say to him. This is like the last thing that I would ever, you know, advise him to say. And I don't think, keep in mind, and this is very important, we've said this before in the course of the book, but it bears repeating. We aren't brighter than or more sensitive than the author of this book. We had a discussion, you know, in the beginning about who authored this. And the Gemara's account of it, and the various times when it could have been, and was it written once and then rewritten by the Great Assembly—all you know, different ideas that we talked about. But as a fundamental principle, it's axiomatic that number one, the author of the book is presenting us something that is this harsh, not because the author believes that a harshness like this is appropriate, but because the author is trying to get across a message. And number two, none of the speakers in this book are meant to be dismissed wholesale. Even if I have problems with what they are saying, let alone the way they are saying it, each of them is meant to express something of philosophical significance or multiple things of philosophical significance. You know, the one that I always use as the example is Sofar's idea that a person might suffer not because they did anything wrong, but because they failed to fulfill their potential. You know, another point here that Bildad is making is, you know, sometimes wicked people suffer because they dug the hole themselves. They're the ones who actually did it to themselves. So, you know, there are points within this that are worth recognizing, even if, on the whole, the instinct of the reader, set up by the very beginning of the book, is to sympathize with Job. There's no question that the book is structured to make us sympathize primarily with Job. He's described as being wonderful in the beginning of the book, and he's being hurt, you know, only because God needs to prove that there's somebody on earth who actually wants a connection to him, who wants a relationship with him. Yeah, and that's cold. That's very difficult. And yes, we are going to be naturally biased towards him. Rita.
I'm going to add to my other comment that good people suffer. Here's a good example. Mm-hmm. He's a good person and has a connection to God, and he is suffering.
Yeah.
And not just the way, like what Newsom said, we believe if we do everything right. Well, that's very, anyone who knows it knows that's a very unrealistic. That doesn't necessarily happen. And this is an example of a good person suffering. And I think maybe later on we'll get into the question. I don't know if it comes later in the book.
Oh, it does. Yeah. We can't get away from it.
And this is where—that's how I see it.
Right. So I'll take you back to what Diana said before, because I think it's part of that, which is that in a sense, yes, you know, the fourth wall is kind of transparent in this book, in the sense that even as all of these speakers are saying, "Oh no, good people, God takes care of them, and they're going to be fine." Right? The reader is being told in the book that Job is a good person and he is not fine. And what he gets in the end of the book is not presented as making him whole. So we have to talk more about that when, you know, one day soon we get to the end of the book. But I think what we'll do is we'll stop with this for now, putting a dent in my hope of finishing chapter 21 before the summer break. But that's worth it. But we've seen Bildad's speech. The next step is to see Job's response in chapter 19. Two things again for those here who are new. Number one, there is a code for getting out of the parking lot. Please see Joyce to make sure that you get to the code so you can get out of the parking lot. Or you can go to the office for a token. But that's number one. And number two is, please make sure, if you're planning on coming back, please make sure to give me your email address so that I will be able to include you on the email list. Thank you very much.